Local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
This is Democracy Now!
I want to express my gratitude and praise the youths who've made this possible. They have protected this country and given it a rebirth, and we wish for this new Bangladesh to progress with speed.
Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus is sworn in as head of Bangladesh's caretaker government just days after student-led protests ousted the prime minister. We'll go to Dhaka. Then, as Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris faces pressure to define her platform on Palestine, we'll speak with Leila Alabet, co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, who spoke with Harris in Michigan.
I was thinking of my community members who are losing hundreds of their family members. And I told VP Harris that. I said, Michigan voters right now want a way to support you, but we can't do that without a policy change that saves lives in Gaza right now.
Then press freedom groups express alarm over felony hate crime charges brought against accredited photojournalist Samuel Seligson after New York police claim he filmed pro-Palestinian activists hurling red paint during a protest. We'll speak with Seligson's lawyer.
It is an extremely concerning assault on the First Amendment. The reason why the freedom of press is so strongly protected is because there's some underlying belief that in order for the public to meaningfully participate in a democracy, they must be actually informed.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israel's launched a new offensive on the southern city of Khan Yunis, attacking dozens of sites after warning people to flee, but offering no safe alternative. This is a mother fleeing yet again with her family.
We are running from the fire. We are running with our children from fear.
Where are you going now?
God knows. We are walking now. They said to go to the humanitarian areas, but there is no safe place here in Gaza. It is all destroyed and damaged.
In Gaza City, multiple children were among at least 15 Palestinians killed in more Israeli strikes targeting schools. At least 30 others were wounded.
Netanyahu, children, only God can help us. He was playing at Abdel Fattah school. He is an innocent child. They say we are terrorists. Look at what Netanyahu is doing. Look at the Arab world. Only God can help us.
Amid the mounting death and destruction, leaders of Qatar, Egypt, and the United States have called on Israel and Hamas to return to ceasefire talks. The official death toll in Gaza is nearing 40,000, though the true toll is likely far higher. In election news, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz addressed the United Auto Workers in Wayne, Michigan, Thursday, where they appeared alongside UAW President Sean Fain. The UAWs endorsed the Democratic ticket in the November election. This is Kamala Harris.
And look, even if you're not a member of a union, you better thank unions.
That 5-day work week. You better thank unions for that 8-hour work day. You better thank unions for that vacation time. So I'm here to say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the sisters and brothers of UAW for all you are and all we will do over these next 89 days.
In Florida, Donald Trump held a rambling hour-long news conference from Mar-a-Lago where he attacked Harris and made a number of false claims, including that nobody died after the January 6th Capitol insurrection and that Democrats believe in killing babies.
The Democrats are really the radical ones on this because they're allowed to do abortion on the 8th and 9th month and even after birth.
Despite these comments, Trump downplayed the issue of abortion in the upcoming election. He also claimed he almost went down in a helicopter ride with former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, and that Brown said terrible things about Kamala Harris. Willie Brown quickly refuted those lies. He said he did not fly in a helicopter with Trump. Trump also claimed he had the largest rallies, at one point comparing his January 6th Stop the Steal rally to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and rally on the National Mall. Also on Thursday, Trump agreed to debate Kamala Harris on ABC News September 10th and called for two additional debates. Harris told reporters she was glad her opponent had finally agreed, adding, quote, hope he shows up. In other campaign news, Kamala Harris's national security advisor, Phil Gordon, denied reports that Harris would consider an arms embargo on Israel. The embargo is a key demand of Palestinian rights defenders. We'll have more on this later in the broadcast with the co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, who met with Kamala Harris yesterday. In more election news, the consumer advocate group Public Citizen called out the Federal Election Commission Thursday after the agency announced it will not regulate AI deepfakes in political ads before November. Public Citizen called it a, quote, shameful abrogation of the FEC's responsibilities. The group pointed to a recent post by ex-owner Elon Musk showing an AI-altered image of Kamala Harris. Musk's post was in violation of his company's own rules against posting misinformation without context. In related news, tech giants Microsoft and Palantir announced they're merging their government cloud computing and AI tools to service U.S. military and intelligence agencies. Palantir's clients include ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, various police departments, and the government of Israel. In Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed an executive order Thursday requiring hospitals to obtain patients' immigration status. Abbott claims the move would help Texas calculate the cost of providing health care to immigrants. Rights groups slammed Texas's latest attack on immigrant communities, which is likely to face legal challenges. The Border Network of Human Rights in El Paso blasted Abbott for, quote, using immigrants as a scapegoat for his failed policies and political frustrations, unquote. Here in New York, a 63-year-old climate activist and musician was arrested Thursday, now faces up to 7 years in prison, performing a piece by Bach during a protest outside the headquarters of Citibank. John Mark Rosendahl, a professional cellist, was arrested alongside 14 other peaceful protesters who encircled Rosendahl to shield him from the police while he performed in the public plaza. Rosendahl spoke briefly before he started playing Bach's suites for cello.
We're here for freedom of speech. I'm playing music here today because we are taught that the purpose of music is to sober and quiet the mind and make it susceptible to divine influences.
His words were interrupted as his fellow activists urged him to start playing as police approached. The protest was part of the Summer of Heat on Wall Street campaign, which has been targeting Citibank with peaceful demonstrations all summer. Some 500 people have been arrested since the actions started. Nobel Peace Laureate Mohammed Yunus has been sworn in as head of Bangladesh's caretaker government just days after the ouster of Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina following weeks of student-led protests. Yunus, a longtime critic of Hasina, took the oath during a ceremony at the presidential palace in the capital Dhaka Thursday evening. Over a dozen other members of Yunus's cabinet were also sworn in, including two students who led the uprising against Hasina, Nahid Islam and Asif Mahmood. Adilur Rahman Khan, a prominent Bangladeshi human rights advocate who was sentenced to 2 years in prison by Hasina's government, will also be an advisor to Yunus's interim government. Mohammed Yunus, known as the Banker of the Poor, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for his work developing microloans. For more, we'll go to Dhaka after headlines. In Tunisia, President Kais Saied has fired Prime Minister Ahmed Hani, replacing him with Tunisia's social affairs minister just 1 year after Haqqani assumed the role. It's the latest shakeup by President Saied in what critics have labeled a constitutional coup and power grab. It comes ahead of Tunisia's October 6th presidential election, where Saied's top opponents have been jailed or barred from running. Earlier this week, five presidential candidates were sentenced to prison, including Abir Moussi, a prominent Saied critic, who was sentenced to 2 years on charges she insulted the Election Commission. In Japan, Nagasaki's commemorating 79 years since the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city, killing an estimated 74,000 people just days after the U.S. killed 140,000 people when it dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. This is Nagasaki Mayor Shiro Suzuki.
With no end in sight for Russia's conflict in Ukraine and fears that the violence in the Middle East may expand, we are currently faced with the possibility of losing the peace we have long taken for granted.
This year's ceremony was marked by a diplomatic row after Nagasaki's mayor declined to invite the Israeli ambassador. In protest, the U.S. ambassador, Rahm Emanuel, and other Western envoys boycotted the ceremony. In Thailand, the recently disbanded Move Forward opposition party has regrouped and announced it's now operating as the People's Party.
Without a doubt, we must win the 2027 election. In the next election, our goal is not just to be the leading party like in the 2023 election, but to win and form a single-party government. The term people in our party's name is not just a name. According to our slogan, by the people, for the people, we aim to create a country where ultimate power truly belongs to the people.
The anti-establishment youth-led Move Forward Party won the most seats last year in the election, but was blocked from taking power. Catalonia's parliament Thursday confirmed socialist Salvador Illa as head of Catalonia's new government, ending more than a decade of rule by the separatist movement. Illa is an ally of Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez. His election was said to be upstaged by the surprise vanishing of the Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont after he spoke at a rally in Barcelona Thursday, then evaded arrest by fleeing to Belgium. Spanish authorities are demanding explanations from police about how Puigdemont was able to return to Catalonia and then go into exile again. In Venezuela, President Nicolas Maduro has blocked access to the X social media platform for 10 days amidst rising tensions over the disputed results of last month's presidential election. Maduro accused his rivals of weaponizing the platform against him and accused ex-owner Elon Musk of spreading hate. In other developments, Venezuela's Supreme Court found opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez, who claims he won the election, to be in contempt of court after he ignored a court summons mandating his presence for an audit of the election. This comes as Venezuela's top prosecutor is launching a criminal probe into Gonzalez and fellow opposition leader Maria Corina Machado after the pair called on the military to abandon its support for Maduro and stop cracking down on protesters. Meanwhile, Chile's president, Gabriel Boric, said he, quote, does not recognize Maduro's self-proclaimed victory. Back in the U.S., Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has called on Sangamon County Sheriff Jack Campbell to resign over mishandling the fatal July shooting of Sonya Massey, a 36-year-old black woman. One of Campbell's deputies shot Massey in her own kitchen after she called 911 for help. Sean Grayson, who is white, has been charged with first-degree murder. This comes as newly released records show several emergency calls were made from Massey's home regarding her mental health in the days leading up to the fatal shooting. In one call to 911, Massey's mother, Donna Massey, reported her daughter was having a mental breakdown. Donna Massey goes on to tell the dispatcher, quote, I don't want you guys to hurt her, and said she feared a police officer who's prejudiced would be sent to her daughter's home. And today marks 10 years since the police killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. His death sparked an uprising led by the Black Lives Matter movement in Ferguson and across the country. Brown had graduated high school just 8 days before his killing. Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, was interviewed recently by GMA3, where she said she's still seeking justice for her son. This is part of that interview.
How would you like for your son, your baby, to be remembered?
As a great big brother, all of his siblings love him. He would have been a great contribution to this world had his time not been cut short.
Michael Brown was killed by white police officer Darren Wilson, but a grand jury and a federal investigation cleared Wilson. St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell, who just defeated Congressmember Cori Bush in a closely watched primary, also refused in 2020 to press criminal charges against Darren Wilson. Today, the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation is set to present Brown's case before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of Brown's mother. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus has been sworn in as head of Bangladesh's caretaker government just days after the ouster of Bangladeshi Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina following weeks of student-led protests. Yunus, a longtime critic of Hasina, took the oath during a ceremony at the presidential palace in the capital, Dhaka, Thursday. Over a dozen other members of Yunus's cabinet were also sworn in, including two students who led the mobilizations forcing Hasina's resignation, Nahid Islam and Asif Mahmood. Adilur Rahman Khan, a prominent Bangladeshi human rights advocate who documented extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, and police brutality, and was sentenced to 2 years in prison by Hasina's government, will also be an advisor to Yunus's interim government while Bangladesh prepares for new elections. Muhammad Yunus is known as the banker to the poor. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for his work developing microloans. On Thursday, Yunus spoke after landing in Dhaka and shared a message for Bangladesh's youth and students.
Using the means of revolution, Bangladesh will create its new dawn of victory. Keeping this vision ahead of us, we have to keep going ahead. I want to express my gratitude and praise the youths who have made this possible. They have protected this country and given it a rebirth, and we wish for this new Bangladesh to progress with speed. We have to protect this freedom. Not just protect it, we have to ensure that it reaches every single household. Otherwise, the freedom will have no meaning.
For more, we're joined by two guests, but we begin in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, with Shahidul Alam, an acclaimed Bangladeshi photojournalist, author, and social activist who's documented human rights abuses, political and social movements. We welcome you to Democracy Now! In 2018, Bangladeshi police arrested Alam from his home over comments he made during an interview with Al Jazeera critical of the government's violent response to nationwide student-led protests at the time. Alam was imprisoned for 107 days and reported being tortured by authorities. He was released following a global campaign by humanitarian groups, media, and journalists. In 2018, Alam was included in a group of journalists called The Guardians that Time magazine recognized as the Person of the Year. On the eve of Thursday's swearing-in, Alam shared a photo of Muhammad Yunus on X from when they met before the Nobel Peace Prize. Shahidul Alam, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of this moment and what brought Bangladesh to this point where Muhammad Yunus, the man you photographed many years ago, is now the head of the caretaker government?
It's a phenomenal event. I mean, I've been through 1971, a war of liberation, and being in the streets on the 5th with people jubilating was a greater thrill than that time, which is difficult to imagine. But it is a difficult process. I mean, this is uncharted territory. The fact that the government has suddenly gone, and there was the few days in between when there wasn't a government. And that potentially and did to an extent lead to local violences, but that's been curbed, and we look forward to a new dawn ahead. I mean, this repression has taken such a toll on so many people for so long. The nation is just hugely relieved.
Tell us what happened. What led to the student-led uprising and why it was the students that took down the prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, who has now fled to India?
It was a people's movement, but triggered by the students. And their initial protest was about an unfair policy regarding government job allocations. And that, I feel, could have been handled well. But it was the arrogance of the tyrant that led to it. They wanted to meet the president. He didn't respond. She, in an interview, sneered at them, calling them razakas, which is a swear word here, because it's about collaborators of the Pakistani army. So essentially something going against our war of liberation, our freedom movement. And the students were enraged. Initially, one of the demands was that she apologize. But this prime minister, or the prime minister we had, is not the apologizing type. Instead, she turned her armed goons on them. They killed six people. When they wanted to bury these people, have a funeral, including there was one young man, Abu Saeed, who'd been shot at point blank by the police in a video that went viral. They instead turned really aggressive, and the police started killing, and eventually it just became a killing spree. So that lit the fuse completely, and then I don't think there was any going back.
Can you talk about your own experience, Shahid al-Alam, being arrested under Sheikh Hasina's government? What happened back in 2018?
I wasn't arrested. I was picked up. It's ironically, it was on the very day, the 5th of August 2018, when they picked me up. And 6 years later, on the 5th of August, she fled. So there's an irony there. But yeah, again, it was a student protest. I'd been documenting it. On the 4th of August, again, the armed goons associated with the government attacked me, attacked my equipment. I was back in the streets on the 5th. That day, I gave an interview to Al Jazeera that night, sitting here in this flat. I was uploading material when the doorbell rang. I went to answer it, and suddenly these burly people came in. They dragged me away, handcuffed me, blindfolded me, put me in this microbus, and took me away. Now, I live in Bangladesh. I know what happened. So what I did was resist and scream as much as I could, so I didn't go away silently. That is one of the things that does happen in Bangladesh, disappearances, and then people just don't appear again. But that night, I was tortured. The following day, they offered me a deal saying if I agreed to stay quiet, I would be let go and there would be nothing on records. When I turned that down, they got very angry. I was taken to jail, to court. In court, I mentioned that I'd been tortured. And the court is required to investigate that, but they did not, and put me into remand, which is a sort of euphemism in Bangladesh for state-sponsored torture. I was there for 6 days. Then I went to jail. Five bail attempts were refused. On the sixth, there was just so much pressure from people in Bangladesh and across the globe that eventually let me go. But even now, today, 6 years after the event, the trial has not begun. The charge sheet has not been placed. The law I was picked up under has been repealed. Yet I appear in court every month. I'm next due to appear on the 14th of August.
And have you spoken with Sheikh Hasina since then, the prime minister? And talk about her role in history, her father and Sheikh Hasina herself.
Well, her father led the movement. He was a principal architect of the movement towards liberation, and he was very revered initially. And then things went wrong. He began to get autocratic himself. He set up a private militia called Rukki Bahini. He disbanded all political parties and created a single party state, except for four newspapers which were pro-government. All other newspapers were banned, and there was huge repression at that time. That was the first of the extrajudicial killings that we've had. He was assassinated on the 15th of August, 2015. And August is meant to be the month of mourning, officially called by the government, because his daughter, until recently, had been the prime minister. But the protesters have turned it around. I mean, July was when I was documenting, or at least the student protest began 6 years ago. Again, July was when the Kota movement began this time, and they've called it the month, the Red Month. And instead of counting the days of August, they've extended July, and it's now a month of red. So that month of mourning has been turned into a month of revolution.
I wanted to go to a clip of Muhammad Yunus, who first joined Democracy Now! In 2008, not long after he won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for pioneering a microloan program that helped hundreds of thousands of impoverished Bangladeshis, mainly women. We also spoke to him in 2017 about his book, A World of Three Zeros, The New Economics of Zero Poverty, Zero Unemployment, and Zero Net Carbon Emissions. The book came out the same time as an Oxfam report, which found the eight richest men in the world own more wealth than half the world's population, more than 3.5 billion people. I asked Muhammad Yunus to talk about zero net carbon emissions and zero poverty.
But the system which we have been practiced, the capitalist system, I said capitalist system is not working towards it. It's a system which, as you mentioned, the eight people owning more wealth than the bottom 50% of the people. It's a system which is like a machine which is sucking up wealth from the bottom and transporting it to the top. So the top is becoming a big mushroom of wealth. And then 99% of the people is like the stem from the mushroom hanging there. And that stem is becoming thinner and thinner. The proportion portion of the wealth devoted to bottom 99% or the 99%, we don't say bottom anymore, will become smaller. And relatively, the top becoming bigger and bigger. So this is a ticking time bomb. Anytime it can explode politically, socially, economically, and so on, we are not paying attention to it. Wealth concentration was going on ever since we introduced capitalist system, but this was not very visible. Today, it's becoming worse and worse. The speed of wealth concentration has become speedier and speedier. Years back, there was a couple of years back, there were 32 people who owned half the wealth of the bottom 50%, and now we have eight. Soon we'll have five. Soon we'll have two people owning the whole entire world's wealth together. So those are the kind of things that threatening. If you when concentration of wealth takes place, it also the concentration of power. Wealth and power go together. So you control the government, you control the politics, you control the media, you control businesses, everything. So that's the kind of situation coming. And all the people at the bottom 10%, 20%, 50%, they will have tremendous anger against the way that's being done and how to express themselves. That will create the destability in the society.
That's Muhammad Yunus taking on capitalism on Democracy Now! In 2017, now just sworn in as the interim head of Bangladesh after a student-led uprising. In addition to Shahid Al-Alam, we're joined by Nusrat Chaudhry, associate professor of anthropology at Amherst College, author of Paradoxes of the Popular, Crowd Politics in Bangladesh. Professor, you grew up in Bangladesh. You're speaking to us, though, from Northampton, Massachusetts. If you can comment on what Muhammad Yunus was saying then, presumably what he believes today, and what that could mean for the future, not only of Bangladesh, but as a world leader for the world.
Thank you. I think one of the things that made Yunus come back and take on this position is the fact that the students really wanted him as the head of the interim government. And one of the reasons for that is that most people in Bangladesh are wary and weary of party politics. So one of the reasons why this particular student protest and the ones that have been successful in the past succeeded, albeit at a very steep cost, is because it didn't start with any particular political party affiliation. The students were very clear from the beginning. They said that if you are a student, you can join us, but don't come here as a representative of any political party. And in a place like Bangladesh, it's difficult to find people who have kind of wide acceptance, who enjoy wide acceptance and recognition from all walks of life, from people of all walks of life. And Muhammad Yunus still enjoys that recognition. He also has, he's globally recognized, he has international legitimacy. So he is one of those people. I am not sure how much his economic vision actually plays a role in this or will play a role in this. Muhammad Yunus, as you know, in his earlier work had talked about social capitalism. His own position has changed. I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to dwell on that. But I think at this point, it's what he represents, having enjoying a kind of recognition beyond party politics is what makes him an ideal candidate for the interim government.
And Professor Chaudhry, the significance of not only the student-led uprising, but now in Muhammad Yunus's government, they have included two students.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is unprecedented in the history of Bangladesh, although almost all of the successful political movements in independent Bangladesh have been led by students. And of course, then ordinary citizens joined them. So it's not surprising that the students led this protest, but their inclusion is unprecedented. But it also symbolizes the fact that you cannot ignore students as the youth, as young, as, you know, not really having the skills to understand what's going on politically, because I think it would be a grave mistake right now for anybody, including the military in Bangladesh, to disregard what the students were saying, because they were able to accomplish something that even the veteran political parties haven't been able to in the last 15 years. They had widespread support from ordinary citizens of Bangladesh. So I think it's great that the students are included. It's also strategic. I don't think you can actually have any kind of you know, policies right now without consulting with the students, who have shown so much maturity and efficiency in actually bringing this uprising about.
And being very clear, even as Sheikh Hasina fled to India and the military said they would, you know, caretake the government until there was an election, they said no to the military, even temporarily, Professor.
Yes, absolutely. There is very little faith. Again, the military is broadly seen as nonpartisan, despite its internal factions. But there is a history in this part of the world of military coups. So the students have been very clear from the very beginning that they don't want an interim government led by the military. And the military right now would make a big mistake if their own political ambitions come in the way. So yes, they have been very clear about having a civilian-led government.
So, Shahid Al-Alam in Dhaka, what's going to happen next? You've got this caretaker government headed by the man who pioneered microloans, not only in Bangladesh, but around the world, Muhammad Yunus. How long does this caretaker government go on? And will there be a role for someone like Khaleda Zia, who was freed just after the prime minister fled? She was the opposition candidate.
Well, Khaleda has been freed. But one of the things that the students also talked about was that they did not want dynasty politics. Khaleda Zia is the widow of General Zia, who was a former president. Sheikh Hasina is the daughter of Sheikh Mujib, who was the founding president. But these families have gone on, and the parties themselves have not been democratic. I think there is a great cry for some other option right now. What we have to see first is how this caretaker government manages this situation. This is uncharted waters. Neither Professor Yunus nor any of the other people in his cabinet have dealt with a situation like this. But then this cabinet has students. This cabinet has more women than in any previous cabinet. It has human rights activists. It has indigenous people. So minorities are also represented. But there are questions. There are questions in terms of the competence of some of the people. There are questions about whether some people are there because they've just been yes men from in the past and, you know, non-threatening. So those are questions that will exist. But to me, the hope is that the students have not stopped there. I was walking down the streets today. There has been violence in the streets because this anger has led to seeking revenge. And the students are managing the streets. The students have gone out in patrols at night to ensure that the robbery and the thuggery does not continue. And the students keep insisting that they want a government which really belongs to the people.
Finally, Shahad Al-Alam, on a slightly different issue, we've noticed in the streets as the tens of thousands of students and others protest that there have been flags of Bangladesh and flags of Palestine. You also have been an outspoken supporter of Palestinian rights. As we move into a segment in the United States and the role that Israel and Palestine will play in this election for the next president of the United States, if you can talk about what's happening here, there.
Well, I've just put on my kafir, which is what I usually wear. I hadn't remembered to do it then. But last night at the swearing-in ceremony, I was the only person from civil, well, only non-student wearing a kafir. One of the students was also wearing a kafir, and the Palestinian ambassador came and hugged us both. But yes, at the time of the protests themselves, I remember a young man atop a tree waving both a Bangladeshi flag and a Palestinian flag. And this is something which is important for a different reason as well. While Bangladesh officially recognizes, talks about Palestine and its liberation, it has actually been trading with Israel. It's used Pegasus and other surveillance material. It's had training with Israel, and it has much more connections in terms of its military and its training than it likes to reveal. And the Bangladeshi public, the Bangladeshi constitution, in fact, says that it will be with all oppressed people across the globe. So it's a natural affinity, but the Bangladeshi people in particular do have a resonance with the Palestinian movement. And I think the students being there will ensure that once we've sorted out the internal things, we will be looking after Palestinian issues.
Well, Shahid Al-Alam, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Bangladeshi photojournalist and activist. He was detained by the Bangladeshi authorities back in 2018, and he was held for more than 100 days, leading a photojournalist in Bangladesh. And Nusrat Chaudhry, we want to thank you for being with us, professor of anthropology at Amherst College, author of Paradoxes of the Popular Crowd Politics in Bangladesh. Coming up, as Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris faces pressure to define her platform on Palestine, we'll speak with Leila Elabed, co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, who spoke with Harris while she campaigned in Michigan on Wednesday. Stay with us. We have to go to war again by Maksud Odaka. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. This is War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. With more than 40,000 Palestinians dead and fears of an escalating regional war, Qatar, Egypt and the U.S. issued a joint statement Thursday calling on Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. They called to, quote, resume urgent discussion on August 15th in Doha or Cairo to, quote, close all remaining gaps and commence implementation of the deal without further delay, unquote. This comes as Vice President Kamala Harris is facing pressure to define her platform on Palestine as the Democratic presidential nominee. On the campaign trail Wednesday, Harris and her vice presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, spoke in Michigan, where more than 100,000 people cast uncommitted protest votes against Biden earlier this year in Michigan's primary election. At a rally in Detroit, Palestinian rights protesters disrupted Harris during her speech.
He intends to end the Affordable Care Act. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
Before the rally, Harris had a short exchange with two leaders of the Uncommitted National Movement who called for an arms embargo on Israel. Also Wednesday, Harris won the backing of the highest-ranking Arab-American official in Michigan's largest county, Wayne County. Assad Terfe told the Associated Press he, too, met with Harris and pressed for a ceasefire and that she, quote, gives us the best chance of achieving peace in that region moving forward, unquote. Meanwhile, Harris's national security advisor later wrote on X, quote, VP has been clear. She will always ensure Israel's able to defend itself against Iran and Iran-backed terrorist groups. She does not support an arms embargo on Israel. She will continue to work to protect civilians in Gaza and to uphold international humanitarian law, unquote. For more, we're joined in Southfield, Michigan, by one of the people who met with Vice President Harris. Leila Elabed is the co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement. Leila, welcome back to Democracy Now! You briefly spoke with the presidential candidate, Vice President Harris, on Wednesday before she addressed that crowd where she was interrupted by Palestinian solidarity protesters. Can you talk about where you were when you talked to her and what you said?
Yes, thank you, Amy, for having me on. When Abbas Alawi and I had this moment to have a brief exchange with Vice President Harris and Governor Tim Walz, we were kind of backstage of the rally in a photo lineup. And it was just a very brief exchange. And I can go in a little bit more detail of, you know, what was said, what I said. In my exchange with her, I got very emotional. I told her, my name is Leila, I'm Palestinian. And in that moment, I was thinking about my community. I was thinking about the two community members I had just spoken to the day prior who told me they had lost over 100 members of their family each in Gaza. And I told Vice President Harris that I told her that. I said, right now, Michigan voters want to support you, but we need a policy change that is going to save lives in Gaza right now. My community members are losing tens to hundreds of their family members. Will you talk to me about an arms embargo? Will you talk to Uncommitted about an arms embargo? Will you meet with us? And she said, yes, she would meet with us. And so I did feel, you know, I was very emotional in that brief exchange. I did feel like her sympathy and empathy towards me was very genuine. But Palestinian children cannot eat words. We need more than sympathy or empathy. We need action. And we know that we know that Kamala Harris's stance right now is not an arms embargo. We know that the policy of the White House is not an arms embargo, which is why we asked her if she would meet with us to talk about an arms embargo.
So what did she tell you in that brief meeting? And in that meeting, did you call for a further meeting? And what was your response to what she said to the protesters as they chanted?
In that brief, very brief exchange, I mean, it was only just a few minutes long. Like I said, I was very emotional, and I was, you know, facing directly towards Vice President Harris. And, you know, she was very comforting. She was very sympathetic and empathetic. And she nodded to everything that I was saying. You know, when I mentioned that our community members are losing tens of hundreds of their family members, she said, it's horrific. And when I said, will you meet with us to talk about an arms embargo? She said, yes, we'll meet with you. And directed me towards some of her staff that we later on got to briefly exchange. So we can have this open window or open door to figure out, you know, what are the next steps to actually having a official sit down meeting. And my response, you know, I know shortly after that, she went on stage. I was not at the rally. Abbas Alawi and I were not at the rally. And so we heard later her response to those press protesters. And I wish her response was one that she led with compassion. I wish that she had addressed those protesters who are advocating for human rights differently. Because that is what these protesters are advocating. They are advocating that their loved ones, their family members, people that look like us, people that share a common language and culture, end this subjugation of violence against them. And they want to be heard.
Let me ask you your assessment of the Minnesota governor, Tim Walz, who is the vice presidential running mate of Kamala Harris, what he has to say about the uncommitted movement that you're co-chair of, Layla.
Yes, I know during the presidential primaries that Governor Walz went on, mainstream TV and said, you know, these are Democrats, these are voters who want to be listened to. Maybe we should listen to them. I do appreciate that that is the point of view that he is coming from. And that is exactly what our movement and voters of Uncommitted want, is we want to be listened to. We demand to be listened to, because right now, the current Gaza policy is a immoral and unpopular policy.
Finally, could you see yourself voting for Harris and Walz? What would it take?
Right now, we need a policy change that will save lives. Until that happens, I don't see Michigan voters coming to support Vice President Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the general election. We are demanding that this collective punishment of Palestinians end. We need a policy change that will protect our family members, our loved ones, and our people in Gaza right now. We want this unconditional, unchecked flow of weapons funding with our American taxpayer dollars, going to a far right wing government.
Layla El Abed, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-chair of the Uncommitted National Movement, and also sister of Congressmember Rashida Tlaib. Next up, press freedom groups express alarm over felony hate crime charges brought against an accredited photojournalist in New York. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Press freedom groups are raising alarm after New York police arrested a local journalist named Samuel Seligson and has charged him with 8 counts of criminal mischief with a hate crime enhancement, which is a felony. Police also raided Seligson's home twice over the past week. They're accusing him of traveling with pro-Palestinian activists who hurled red paint at the homes of top officials of the Brooklyn Museum in June. The Associated Press reports the complaint describes Seligson as a participant in the crime, but a law enforcement official told the AP he was not directly involved in the spray painting or property damage. He is a video journalist who's contributed footage to many news outlets. The Committee to Protect Journalists has criticized Seligson's arrest. Catherine Jacobson of CPJ said it's really important for authorities and the broader public to understand and differentiate the difference between protesters and journalists, quote. The Freedom of Press Freedom, the Freedom of the Press Foundation warned Seligson's arrest and his attempt to criminalize journalism. On Thursday, I spoke to Samuel Seligson's lawyer, Lena Whiddy, and began by asking her to describe what actually happened.
My client, Samuel Seligson, is a 32-year-old independent videographer. He is being charged with 8 counts of criminal mischief, as you said, with a hate crime enhancement. At this stage, it's not clear that the state has not provided any evidence that he was involved in property damage and that he was involved in any way beyond merely being present. If that is in fact the case, that is obviously consistent with his role as a journalist in documenting protest activities. And in fact, as you said, the NYPD has made statements to the press that they do not, that they are not alleging him to have been involved in the property damage. So it's extremely concerning, shocking to me and to my client that he's being charged with not only felony criminal mischief, but a hate crime enhancement. And
what does that mean, a hate crime enhancement?
A hate crime enhancement essentially means that the category of the crime, of the underlying crime for which you're charged, is bumped up.
So, from misdemeanor to felony?
Well, in this case, the criminal mischief in the third degree is an E felony, so it's bumped up to a D felony, which makes it one bail eligible and increases the potential sentence for a person if they're convicted. And is, of course, you know, I think significant in the way the public views conduct, significant in the way that, that the court system deals with conduct, and is absolutely dangerous in terms of the precedent that it sets for any pro-Palestine protesters and journalists covering that protest. It necessarily perpetuates the narrative that any protest against the support for genocide is necessarily synonymous with protest against Jewishness. And my client himself is Jewish, as are many other anti-Zionist protesters.
His home was raided twice?
Yes.
What does that mean?
That means the police went into his home on 2 separate occasions, attempted to arrest him, and on both occasions handcuffed his roommates and searched for him. And on the second occasion, we had already arranged a surrender with the NYPD, and I had been in touch with the detective on the case, and he had planned to turn himself in, and yet a second raid was executed on his home.
So he is, you're arguing 2 things here. One is, does the police have evidence that he was even at the homes of the Brooklyn Museum officials documenting what the activists were doing?
So, yes, in order for the state to prove this case against him, they would have to prove 2 things. One, that he was in fact there, they would have to prove his identity. And 2, that if he were there, he participated in the criminal mischief beyond mere presence, because merely being present, whether you're a journalist or not, is not enough to sustain criminal charges against you. So that he was there, that he participated beyond mere presence, and that he participated with the intent to damage property, and because of the hate crime enhancement, that he participated and was motivated, at least in part, by the identity of the people who own the homes. So by the race, national origin, sexual orientation of those people, and those are the protected classes that hate crimes legislation purportedly protects. Now, we know that hate crimes legislation, like other laws, is used in reality to actually prosecute the most vulnerable and not to protect the most vulnerable. My client is an independent journalist. He's Jewish himself. He's being accused, along with the other 5 individuals, is being accused of a hate crime for, even if true, protesting the homes of executives of multi-million dollar corporations who leverage extensive financial, cultural, political power and use that power in support of the genocide. And that is clearly what the protest is about. And it's absurd that it is being portrayed as crimes against the, as hate crimes because of some tangential relationship that these people may have to a protected class that my client is in fact part of. He is part of that protected class. He is Jewish.
Now, Samuel Seligson was previously arrested in May. Is that right?
That's
live streaming a pro-Palestinian demonstration.
That's correct. With his press credentials, live streaming, thrown to the ground by police as people yelled, he's press, he's press, he's press. And that case was not ultimately prosecuted by the district attorney's office.
Right. A spokesperson for the Brooklyn DA said the case had been closed and sealed.
I'm not representing him on that case, but my understanding is that it hasn't been prosecuted, that when he appeared for court, the district attorney's office was not prepared and you know, gave him a letter saying that he would be informed if they decided to prosecute the case.
Do you believe that the mayor is in any way involved in having him arrested? Of course, Mayor Adams is a former police officer himself.
You know, I can't speculate on what his specific role is, but we do know that Mayor Adams has been a huge proponent of ramping up police at pro-Palestine protesters, at pro-Palestine protests, excuse me. He has signed off on millions of dollars in overtime for the NYPD, who we have seen use increasing violence against Palestine protesters. You know, we're now 10 months into the genocide and the violence at these protests continues. Meanwhile, Mayor Eric Adams is a huge proponent for cutting public services like the New York Public Library and 3K. And, you know, the hate crimes legislation is supposed to protect the most vulnerable people. It's supposed to prevent race-based violence. And actually, where we're seeing so much of that race-based violence in New York City is at these protests committed by the NYPD against Black and Brown people, against Palestinians, and against anti-Zionist Jews. And you know, the city's resources would be much better spent addressing that.
So you're Palestinian American. You're a Palestinian American lawyer representing a Jewish journalist. If you can talk about how this fits into what you see as a broader crackdown on the pro-Palestinian protests, and particularly start by addressing groups like the Committee to Protect Journalists and the press freedom groups that are standing up for Samuel.
Yes. Yeah, so it's wonderful to see all of these press groups standing up for Samuel, speaking out against the assault on journalists. And this is an assault on journalists that is happening worldwide. We are now 306 days into the genocide, and over 100 journalists, as you know well, have been massacred and many more detained by Israel. This is an attempt to, it is an extremely concerning assault on the First Amendment. The reason why the freedom of press is so strongly protected is because there's some underlying belief that in order for the public to meaningfully participate in a democracy, they must be actually informed. And criminalizing the press, manufacturing risk that they will be prosecuted if they cover protests, is extremely chilling behavior. And everyone should be speaking up about it. Everyone should be concerned. Everyone should be identifying this as a political decision and not a legal one. It is political to charge a journalist with a crime while he is, you know, again, if he is proven to be there and if there is no evidence that he engaged in any of the underlying property damage, that he was just doing his job. It's extremely concerning that he's being charged, and even more concerning that he's being charged with a hate crime. And it's concerning that all of these people are being prosecuted for hate crimes, because it is an absolute misuse of the hate crimes legislation. And again, an exploitation of the law, which is not new, unfortunately, in this country, as we all know very well, an exploitation of the law to prosecute the most vulnerable in favor of the most powerful. And in this case, it's very stark.
Lena Widdy is attorney for Samuel Seligson, a New York City-based journalist charged with felony hate crime for allegedly filming pro-Palestinian activists hurling red paint at the homes of top officials at the Brooklyn Museum. Seligson's work has appeared in Reuters, Al Jazeera, ABC, and Fox News. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for director of development to support our fundraising efforts and an archives intern to support our archives team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Our house is a very, very, very fine house. Late in the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As a